Nothing's certain in politics, but professionals know one thing. Subscribing to the Cook Political Report is the right decision in every election cycle.
For more than four decades, the Cook Political Report has been providing political professionals with the right analysis to help them invest political capital with confidence.
A deep knowledge of the past, combined with a meticulous, unbiased analysis of the present, produces the most accurate predictions of the future, time and time again.
Because it's all backed by data from every input that decides elections for president, Congress, and governorships.
Subscribers to the Cook Political Report get the clarity they need through smart analysis that you won't get anywhere else.
Like the very latest outlook for every race and access to our analysts. Amy Walter, David Wasserman, Carrie Dan, Jessica Taylor, Aaron Covey, and Matthew Klein.
The Cook Political Report offers
the right analysis.
The right analysis.
The right analysis.
The right analysis.
For getting it right.
Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Hello, welcome to The Odd Years. I'm Amy Walter. When we booked this episode with Pod Save America co-host Dan Pfeiffer several weeks back, our plan was to talk about the Democrats' strategy and messaging around Trump, something Dan's been writing about for his Substack, MessageBox. Should Democrats just focus on the economy? Should they raise alarm bells over deportations? How loudly and strongly should they push back against Trump? And we do discuss that, but as it turned out, there was a lot more to talk about with Dan. For one, as a former Obama senior advisor, I wanted to ask his thoughts on the new reporting coming out about Joe Biden's health and how his inner circle worked to conceal it. Also, we received an important report from the data firm Catalyst about 2024 voters, shedding more light on why Kamala Harris lost and Donald Trump won. As a fellow data nerd, I knew Dan would be ready to dive into it. We recorded this on Wednesday, May 21st, and bonus, you can watch our entire conversation on our YouTube channel. Okay, here's Dan Pfeiffer.
Dan Pfeiffer, hello. Thank you for joining me.
Happy to be here.
So you're a man who wears many hats. You're a communications guy. You're a political strategist guy. You're a podcast guy.
Yeah, like everyone else these days.
Like everyone else these days. But I want you to just put on the Dan Pfeiffer hat for a minute,
yep.
Just you as yourself, and talk about the revelations coming out about Joe Biden, both his challenges as president with this new book, his mental acuity challenges, as well as the cancer diagnosis. I would love to just get your personal perspective on all of this.
Sure. I mean, obviously the cancer diagnosis is incredibly serious and sad, and like so many other people, although not everyone in politics, you know, thinking about and sending all the best possible wishes to President Biden and his family as he fights, as he deals with his cancer and as he fights. You know, it's an interesting moment, and we can talk about it if you want, about how we went from the shocking news, right? Because it was this very serious cancer that seems to come out of nowhere, and people respond as humans mostly to say, like, this is sad, we're thinking about you, keep fighting, all the normal human responses to someone with a cancer diagnosis. And then within only a few hours, we are down to, you know, dangerous conspiracy theories, allegations, questions, you know, and it's fair to ask questions, but not a lot of those questions are being asked in good faith. And so like that, like it's almost a very telling moment sort of in American politics. So like that is one thing. And I find that to be entirely separate than the larger questions that are happening this week before the diagnosis.
Right.
That are in Jake Tapper and Alex Thompson's book, which I have read. And that raises, you know, a set of serious questions for the Democratic Party about how we got to this moment. Mm-hmm. And you can have those questions and want to have that conversation without, even if you don't buy the premise that there was some massive cover up either between within the Biden administration, within the Democratic Party writ large, or in the media to hide Biden's age. But the most important part from a purely political perspective is the voters were not surprised by any of this, like maybe the details, but they were telling Democratic voters included, majorities of Democratic voters were telling pollsters for years that Biden was too old. They didn't think he should run for re-election. And President Biden and his team did not listen. Not enough Democrats spoke out publicly about that. And we put ourselves in a position where a winnable election, a tough environment, but a winnable election was lost with great, great consequences that we're seeing every day.
You know, you worked in the White House. You've had that rare experience of actually having to probably tell the most powerful person in the world something they don't want to hear. Tell us about that, because it does seem that what you have beyond what the Biden family, how they were processing through the president's health and concerns about that, what is the staff doing? And where were they complicit, and what should they have done better or more of?
The most interesting revelation, not just in Original Sin, but in a lot of the reporting post-debate and post-election, was that there was never a real process or meeting with the staff or the close advisors to discuss the question of whether Joe Biden should run. Because that is a question for any president running for election. Like, we had those conversations with Barack Obama, who was much younger and in a much different political position. Like, that was a conversation. Like, there was a meeting to discuss it. Like, it was sort of fait accompli he was going to run, but he wanted to test the proposition of, like, how winnable the race was. What does it look like? And the fact that that didn't happen with Biden, especially given the fact that most people believed he had made something akin to a one-term pledge, is a real failure. Now, the failure always comes from the top. Right. If the president does not want to have that meeting, no one can make him have that meeting. And I think the other challenge in just reading the reporting and knowing a little bit from the people who work there and knowing how President Biden works is he has a very, very, very tight circle of people. And it's very small. Many of them have been with him forever. It is like loyalty is prized above all else. And it seems, at least in the reporting, at least particularly in the Tapper Thompson book, that to suggest otherwise would be a sign of disloyalty, and that could get you evicted from the meetings you need to be in. It's never easy to tell the president what they don't want to hear. Some presidents are more willing to hear that than others. President Obama was, I was lucky that that was almost a test. I've seen it happen with new staff with President Obama, is if the person passed on the moment to tell him the thing he didn't want to hear or to disagree when they obviously disagree, like that was a mental note he made that person maybe wasn't willing to give him what the information he wanted to have. It doesn't seem like, at least in the reporting, that's how the Biden White House worked, or that's what President Biden wanted. And the other thing, and this is, it's always hard to know, but I can't remember where I read this. It may have been from either Jake or Alex talking about the book, but seems pretty clear from the reporting that obviously they took steps to minimize the political fallout of the president's age. Like, I don't even mean mental cognitive decline. Like, he couldn't do the job. Like I'm not saying even that, just like, the walking, the doing the interviews, like the stairs in Air Force One, they made steps to sort of hide that. But it seems as that President Biden also was not aware of his own political situation, that he was not getting the information he needed. Because that comes out in all the reporting on the phone calls with Nancy Pelosi and others, because I'm winning. Yeah. And every person who has access to 538 or the Cook Political Report knows that that's not actually the case, but he didn't seem to know that.
All the polls look great for me. Yes.
Yes.
No, they do not.
When none of the polls look right. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right. So now let's shift into the Dan Pfeiffer putting on his strategic communications hat. You're advising candidates in 2026 for maybe 2028. How should they be talking about this?
It depends on who the candidate is. Like, it is easier if you were just a random member of Congress to talk about this than if you were in the president's cabinet or you were a Senate leader who was meeting with him on a somewhat regular basis.
Yeah, if you're Chuck Schumer and you go on TV and they ask you about it and he just keeps deflecting and say, we're looking forward, we're looking forward, we're not going back. That doesn't seem like the right answer.
You just have to answer it honestly, which is, and I think like this is complicated because it seems clear that the president had good days and less good days. And you may not have seen him on the less good days. And I actually, this is in the book, but I've only seen President Biden once since he was elected. And I was at a reception at the White House, around the White House Correspondents' Dinner. He gave remarks. He was not good. Like, he told the same story twice in there. He just seemed really, like, to me, old and tired. Not in some form of, like, cognitive decline. Like, I haven't seen him in person before that for since Obama left the White House, and he recognized me. So it was like, but you see him and you're like, oh, that, but I also know that no president's best moment is 7 p.m. on a Friday night. Like that, even Obama was not happy there. And so I think for Democrats, you just have to answer it honestly, which is obviously Joe Biden should not have run. You can have that position no matter where you come down on what his mental fitness was before, right? It just that was a fundamental mistake, because we need to transition, you know, he needed to be the bridge to the next generation that he promised to be. The voters were looking for something different, and we did not listen to the voters, and that never works. So I would just answer it honestly and openly and just be very clear. And I don't think we have to hedge around. You can give President Biden credit for the good things he did, and they also acknowledge that his decision to run for re-election was the wrong one and came with some pretty significant and serious consequences for the country and the party.
Do you think it's done deep damage to the trust that Democratic voters have in their leadership? I mean, there's clearly been a lot of frustration we're seeing in the polling about how Democrats feel about the party. And do you think this was a big reason for the declining trust?
Biden's numbers went down and the party's numbers started to go down before Biden even announced he was running for re-election. So I think there is a larger Joe Biden political problem for the party. He was it's not his fault. He was president during the first inflation in 40 years. And he sort of came to represent something that was not as much change as people wanted, right? It was a defense of a broken political system. So I need to see more evidence to say that how Democrats responded to the questions around Joe Biden's age is the specific reason or a driving reason of why our party's approval ratings are in the dumps. I think it is fair that this idea that the voters told us they wanted one thing and we did the other one thing without, and we're pretty dismissive of the concerns. And that was true in the early days of inflation too, just sort of this I know better approach. And I think that hurts with the base. It seems I would have this experience in like 2022 where I'd be like at a barbecue with people who aren't in politics or like a kids event with all the parents. And people would say, Joe Biden's obviously not running for re-election. Like they'd be shocked when I said that.
I got that every time from normal people would say that to me all the time. He's not running, right?
Yeah. And then if you go to DC, you're in meeting people in politics. Like, of course he's running for re-election. And that dissonance, I think, was problematic. Because when you just tell people, when people see one thing and you tell them the other thing, that has consequences. We have a hole to dig out of. That hole is not just because of Joe Biden, but sort of the reaction to his presidency and then his decision to run for re-election is part of that hole.
I think that is very, very well said. And speaking of a hole, you and I both dug into the Catalyst 2024 data. For those who don't know what Catalyst is, it's a Democratic data analytics company, very well respected actually across the aisle and with academics. And what they do is they dig into the voter file. So it's basically an exit poll, but with an ability to actually look at who came in and who came out of the electorate. And you and I both kind of came to the same conclusion, which is it's quite remarkable to see in print just how much the Obama coalition, that coalition that you and your colleagues put together in 2008 and 2012, has shifted to becoming the Trump coalition. Younger voters, voters of color. I mean, Dan, I thought of you when I was looking through that data, and I was just thinking, if I had called the Obama campaign in 2012 and said, hey, the electorate is going to be only 72% white and is going to be more heavily Latino than ever and is going to be younger than ever, Chicago would have been over the moon. They'd say, we're gonna win by 10 points.
Yeah.
That actually hurt Democrats this time. So what happened?
I mean, like what you have hit on here, when you say the Obama coalition became the Trump coalition, that what that's specifically referring to, and you made this clear in your piece on it, but is that in 2008, 2012, Obama was the emerging coalition. It was a coalition driven by the fastest growing parts of the population. It was a movement that did better the more people voted. You were rooting for higher turnout. You were trying to register as many new voters as possible. You're trying to bring as many people into the process as you can. And there was this wealth of voters out there that you could go get. We used to call it, you know, it was a very expandable electorate, right? The states that where there were lots of voters who were not registered were states we wanted to compete in because we thought those were our voters. We just had to go turn them out. And Republicans back in the 2010s were hanging on for dear life to this shrinking out of step coalition. that happen to vote more often than the other coalition. So you could win some elections, but you know, there was an expiration date on the whole thing. And that is completely flipped over the course of 12 years. And that's incredibly alarming. And so I think it's a couple of things. And there are no easy answers here. Democrats have lost the cultural war since 2016. Like if you're 30 years old right now, here's your Democratic politicians. You had Hillary Clinton, who, if you were under 30, you did not love and probably did not support in the primary. You had Joe Biden, who you did not love and did not support in the primary, but then did turn out for because you wanted to beat Donald Trump. Then Joe Biden stayed when you thought he was going to leave. And then you end up with Kamala Harris, who you might have liked in a different scenario, but she was thrust upon you with 106 days to go. So for an entire, more than a decade, the face of the Democratic Party was someone that could not connect with young people on a cultural level in a way that Bill Clinton could, and to a certain extent in the 90s, and Obama certainly could in 2008, 2012. And we're not cool. We're not interesting. We have become in the minds of a lot of us, not always fair, but sort of the crossing guard party, the hall monitor party. So that's one. So we lost cultural war. The other thing is we truly, and this is related, but we got absolutely killed in the communications world shifted and we did not shift with it in any real way. We are still a party that is incredibly dependent on the twin vehicles of the traditional media and paid television advertising to communicate. And that is very, very effective in midterms when you have highly engaged older voters who still consume linear television. When you get to the general electorate, voters under 40 do not watch and do not consume ads. And this is such an important point that gets lost. We spend all this money to buy ads on football games or The Bachelor, these few quasi monocultural events where people can watch it because there will be young people watching. But they are culturally attuned to not believe television ads. Mm-hmm. And this is like what they believe and what they listen to is influencers with whom they have a relationship with online, a parasocial relationship with. And then, you know, for people of my generation, we'll say, that seems insane. Why would you trust Joe Rogan to tell you what supplements to buy? And they would be like, why would you trust GlaxoSmithKline to tell you what medicine to buy? So we did not develop a infrastructure or a muscle or a strategy for communicating in the new media in a way that was effective. And you could see that in how the Harris campaign communicated, with a few notable exceptions, like the Caller Daddy interview throughout that 106 days.
Let's get to the chicken and the egg of that, which I think is such a good point, because you can argue that without Donald Trump, Republicans wouldn't have had an inroad into those new areas of communication, right? Because he was such a cultural icon and because he was so comfortable in those spaces, right? This is a guy who did reality TV before reality TV was really a thing. Yeah. So he was totally comfortable going on, like, yeah, I'll go on a podcast. Yeah, I'll show up on a YouTube video. Yeah. What seems to me that's also happening, Dan, is that the conversations that Democrats are having aren't connecting with younger voters, even though theoretically they could argue they're on the right side of the issues like abortion or gay rights, where younger voters are, and yet culturally they're out of step. So how does that make sense?
You have to have the right politicians, right? It always flows from who's at the top. And it seems crazy to people like me that Trump can do this and have that sort of appeal with young people, but he can. And it's just like, we should take a lesson from the fact that young voters disagree with him on what we believe to be, like in the Democratic belief, the core issues of young voters: climate change, abortion, LGBTQ plus rights, student loan. He comes in, he cancels the student loan forgiveness, like his first thing. But he connects with some portion of them culturally. He seems like someone who will fight for them, who can relate to them, who is against the system that they feel is not serving them. And we have to probably start working. Like, we are very issue forward in our party, and we're very serious with all the I's dotted and the T's crossed issue forward. And we have to think a little larger, a little more symbolically about how we talk about issues. Our issues have to, like, just, there's this idea that has been true in the Democratic Party since as far as I can think back, where it's just like that these voters are going to sit down with two competing stacks of white papers and they're going to go through them and see which one, with like you have a calculator, which one's going to help my bottom line more, and that's the person you're going to vote for. And that has never been true, and it's probably even less true now that people are so cynical and distrustful of the politicians to deliver those things. And Trump's had this real advantage. Is it's a time of high cynicism, high distrust in establishment institutions, and he's threatening to burn down the system. And people, you know, that showed up throughout all the New York Times, Siena polling, that people would rather, they would rather burn down the system as it is than keep it. And we just could never found a way to speak that because we were just so inherently insider in our approach to everything.
Quick break. We'll be back with Dan Pfeiffer. It might be a political odd year, but here at the Cook Political Report, we're as busy as ever. Over the last few weeks, we've rolled out our race ratings for governors, the House, and the Senate. It's not too early to think about next year's midterms, and we have everything you need to know about these races. But it's only available to Cook Political Report subscribers. So don't wait. Join us. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD, the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers.
The economy is once again the top conversation in our politics, the tariff issue, cost of living, Medicare and Medicaid. How do Democrats talk about this in a way that those voters who feel like they aren't connecting with Democrats, or where Democrats aren't connecting with them on those issues?
It starts with the very simple proposition of running down or driving down how they think about Trump and the Republicans on the economy, which we have that advantage now with the tariffs, with just how people feel. The fact that he ran on the economy and costs and then decided to launch a high profile, chaotically rolled out policy to raise costs and weaken the economy. And that used, like, even if his approval rating is maybe ticking up a little bit here, his economic approval and his job approval are now online in a way in which they weren't before. What that has done, I think, is pierce the bubble or undermine the core political strength of Trump, other than his communication skills, is that because he was a quote unquote businessman who played a businessman on reality TV on a highly watched show for a decade, people think of it, he has this credibility as someone who can manage the economy. And then he had the advantage of the fact that people look back very fondly on the economy compared to now from his first term, even if there's little evidence that he did more than simply just not destroy the economy that Barack Obama built over 8 years, in my personal opinion. So you have that nostalgia. The way he's handled the first 150 days or whatever it is of his first term has undermined the first part of it. And so I think we have to do that. And then I think actually we're going to solve our economic problems by, where it's not going to be new policies. We're not going to come up like, oh, here's our expanding Social Security policy, although I'd be fine if we were for that, or here's our new version of universal health care, although I'd be fine if we were for that. We have to affect our brand, and we have to be seen as people who will take on powerful interests in the system as is. And one way to do that, and we need the right candidates to do this, is to run as reforming outsiders, populist reformers. And I think Trump has given this huge opportunity with the rampant corruption in his administration, with all the billionaires running things, with the role Elon Musk had, that we should really take a page out of the 2006 playbook, and where Democrats help come back in a very similar situation, bounce back from a very tough election loss to a president who very well could have lost re-election by becoming reformers. And who you put at the face of that is very important. We need the right candidates for that.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Is there somebody that right now you see as being effective there? Obviously, Bernie Sanders and AOC are making that exact case.
Yeah.
Are they the right faces? Or at least AOC, obviously Bernie would be.
Yeah.
I think certainly not running for again for president.
I think that most professional Democrats underestimate how powerful a political figure AOC could be. She is an outsider. She can communicate in the modern ways. She, like Trump and like Obama and some others, she knows how to get attention and use it. And that is incredibly powerful. And it helps her so much that the Republicans always attack her for being a bartender or a cocktail waitress. Like that, they are, keep doing that, right? If you want that, because you don't seem like a politician. You seem like a normal person who could relate to young people. And like, obviously, her approval ratings and other things, you know, would go in the con column, but she would be a cultural phenomenon if she were to run for president in a way that, you know, I don't know if that means she would win the nomination or not, but I think would be much more powerful than people think and could do a lot to actually reverse some of the stuff we saw in the Catalyst report, that with the gains Trump made with certain segments of the voters, working class voters, younger voters, Latinos, I think across the board. I also think Ruben Gallego is someone who has a similar, he's a different approach, but he is a very, he really comes off as a normal guy. He's a veteran. He can go into, like, with the with young men. He's someone who demonstrated this in his Senate race, who thinks very creatively about how to do that, who can go into some of these spaces that we sort of annoyingly call the manosphere online and have conversations and talk to people. Like Pete, the what Pete Buttigieg did on the Flagrant podcast is an example of someone who could do this. Probably not highlighting transportation secretary in his resume the whole bunch over the course of that, but he also is a good communicator, knows how to get attention, and has a unique story that doesn't feel like a traditional politician. And so, you know, those are some examples there. I think there's two paths for the Democratic Party here. One is this could be the 2028 nomination, be one of those nominations you really want. It looks a lot like George H.W. Bush at the end of his third term, because this sort of feels like Trump's third term. It's at the end. We've been living in this Trump decade forever. He doesn't deliver on his promises. People sour. He has low approval ratings. His potential successors are not particularly exciting. And any Democrat could be a decent candidate could win that, right? It's just one of those where if you win the nomination, you might end up being the favorite for the presidency just because people are going to snap back after all of this. Over the long term, though, like another, which is sort of what Biden was like an interregnum presidency. Like what Democrats really have to wrestle with, and you know this better than anyone else, is what the 2032 electoral map's going to look like, because the population shifts. You know, you could see, you know, in California and New York losing a total of 7 electoral votes and Florida and Texas gaining 7 electoral votes. You're going to see losses in those blue wall states. The blue wall path will not be available to Democrats in 2032. And so you're going to need someone who can win a high turnout election with a diverse emerging coalition. And that has to be someone who is not just an accidental president in 2028. And so there is this argument to the party that you have, like, we could win the House in 2026, but just by kind of just existing, right? Like not stepping on a rake. And we could possibly, although it's not guaranteed, you could just win the White House. But if you were playing the long game for the party, we have to fundamentally change so much of how we, of what we represent to voters, that we need a very different coalition going forward, or we are going to look like the Democratic Party in the 80s.
I will be fascinated to see who candidates in 2026, candidates who are on the ballot in 2026, invite to come campaign with them. Yeah. I mean, I remember in 2006, everybody wanted Obama.
Yep.
Not many people were okay with Hillary Clinton, but they weren't clamoring for her in the way they were clamoring for Obama in all kinds of districts. So I'll be very curious to see if they bring Gallego. Does AOC go to a Michigan swing seat?
Yeah.
Or do those Democrats go, it's a little too risky? So it'll be fascinating.
Here's the thing, people. Photoshop exists. You can either stand with the person and get the crowd, or you can have the NRCC put your photo next to hers and put it in an ad. Like people aren't going to forget. Nancy Pelosi ended up in all those ads for all those years. She didn't go to all those districts. And so just don't, what you're hinting at is a little bit of the problem for the Democratic Party is this massive risk aversion. Like, do the safest possible, most boring thing and hope that things fall in our way, as opposed to swing for the fences and try to really win. And I think, like, there'll be some places where maybe AOC won't go where they will want her, but I think it'd be a mistake to take, let's take the person who's getting, with Bernie, tens of thousands of people in March of the off year, or the odd year, given where we are, and not bring them to your district. Like, that, to me, that seems crazy. It's a different world. Obama had this, like, he had incredibly high approval ratings with Republicans coming off his 2004 convention. So it was safer thing, but, like, if we always opt for the safest, most least risky path, we're going to end up right where we've been. That's what we've been doing as a party for the last 12 years now. And we have to change that.
Yeah. Running not to lose versus running to win.
Yes. Yes. That is, that was my giant frustration as a Democrat pre-Obama, was that just felt like that's all we were doing is just, what's the, you know, I remember Matt Bai, the who runs the New York Times Magazine, told me that Democrats' strategy was the slot machine strategy is we're not going to do anything. We're just going to pull the lever and then hope we're going to get three diamonds and win. And so there's like this sort of naive hope plus like this caution. And, you know, and I remember this with Obama so well was it was very early on. I was his traveling press secretary in the first few months of that campaign. And we were traveling everywhere. And he did an interview with David Brooks, which all seems crazy for a candidate to do now. And he talked about how maybe it was Fareed Zakaria. I can't remember. But he did an interview it was Thomas Friedman. And in it, he talked about how one of the most beautiful, they were talking about the Middle East, and one of the most beautiful sounds was the call to prayer. Mm-hmm. And we had a whole conversation like in the morning call being like, that is an insane thing for Barack Hussein Obama to say in early 2007, you know, potentially running against John McCain and like we're highlighting this weakness. And so they're like, Dan, I know you've worked on the campaign for 3 weeks, like the rest of us, can you go talk to the senator about why he shouldn't say that? Cause I went over there and I did it. And he sort of looked at me as like, we're not playing that way. We're not playing scared of like national security politics. We're just going to like do our thing. And I think we need more Democrats who just think that way. Just be brave. And like, that gets at the AOC thing, right? Like, I have no idea if she's going to run or if she's the right nominee, but like there's real talent there and Democrats should be open to that, because one of the tests of electability for Democrats in 2028 should not just be what your approval ratings are, what your numbers look like with this segment of swing voters. It should be, can you communicate? Can you get your message out? Can you navigate tricky situations? Can you go on, like, I know Rogan's a stand-in for them, but can you go on these podcasts and deal with people? Can you go on Fox News and hold your own? Can you get on the debate stage and hold your own? Like, we have to think about how you gain, utilize, and leverage attention as one of the core tests of electability. And we should look at that with all the candidates, because a lot of candidates look great on paper, but when it push comes to shove, they cannot do it or are unwilling to do it or too risk adverse to do it. And so we should look like that should be like for every activist, for every Democratic operative, for every donor, that should be a test we look at.
Which leads me directly to this question that I wanted to ask you. In fact, it was the reason I wanted you on the podcast in the first place. Well, first of all, I love talking to you, but you had written something right when this Abreu-Garcia conversation was starting, speaking of risk averse, and there was this whole debate, and I think there's still a debate among Democrats about whether to avoid talking about immigration. This is an issue that benefits Donald Trump. It's a so-called 80-20 issue for Republicans, and Democrats should stay far away from it. Just talk about the economy, just talk about healthcare. And you wrote, too many are leaning exclusively into economic arguments, letting Trump's offenses against our democracy go unchallenged. So I want you to talk a little bit about that as we think not just about this specific case, but just more broadly as Democrats are messaging throughout these next few years of Trump's administration.
You have to talk about the elephant in the room. You look ridiculous if you don't. If the news is filled with stories of Trump disappearing people without due process to a El Salvadorian prison known for torture and starvation, and you just vomit up talking points about tariffs and inflation, you look ridiculous. You look like a politician. Just like go talk authentically. Like if you talk to Democrats privately, they all think this is horrendous and terrible and they're passionate about it, but only some of them are talking about it in that way. The others think, oh, this is a mistake. You just have to talk about things. We overthink this stuff so much. I think we have as a part, and I am a huge data nerd, but I think we have become captive to random controlled tested messaging, where it's like, obviously, if you ask people what the most important message is, they're going to say, I don't cut Medicaid or Obamacare or Medicare to pay for tax cuts for the wealthy. That has been the best testing message, you know, since Medicare passed, right? It's like, obviously that, but you have to sort of go talk about the things that are happening. That's one thing Trump is very good about. He sees where attention is, and he goes and talks about it. And talking passionately and authentically about something you care about and seeming like you have the strength and the courage to talk about it has value, even if it doesn't show up in the immediate poll testing of that language. Like, no one is like telling Trump not to go talk about some of these things. Like, they seem crazy to talk about it. He does. And, you know, it's one of the things that showed up in, I think this was David Shore's firm that can't remember who did it, but there was a, I saw one of these tests where, like, these are the most popular messages. And like, it was early in the budget process. So like, this Medicaid message is by far the most popular. It's in the 99th percentile of all message tested, messages tested, whatever else. But it only, like, there was only like 4% of all political TikToks were about the budget. It's like, you have to find, Democrats work, find the most persuasive message, and Democrats find, and Republicans tend to look for the most engaging message online and try to make it persuasive. And I think we need to think a little bit more like that. And that is really important when it dovetails with what you actually believe and you actually are passionate about. Whatever, just people just have to be like, take the blinders off, just get out there and talk more about the things you care about. And we would benefit so much as a party from doing that.
And so what about the issues where you can see that Democrats are uncomfortable, like on the trans sports issue? Yeah, I think you're right. They have to have an answer. You can't just say, I'm going to pivot and talk about tariffs. Yeah. How do you do that authentically without seeming like you're just reading a talking point memo?
Yeah, I mean, it's not easy, right? And some people are going to be better at it than others. I think one thing to do is to call out what the Republicans are doing with the transport issue, talk about how few people this actually impacts, and talk about what they're trying to distract from, and show real sympathy and compassion for trans people in this country.
Though, to meet where a lot of voters are right now, which is there's a concern about fairness.
Yeah.
There's a concern about safety. There are all those things that I think this is where Democrats have gotten themselves sort of twisted around the axle, is not addressing the real concerns that people have about a lot of these issues.
I think you can talk to people's, you can acknowledge people's concerns about that. The President of the United States and senators are not the ones like regulating the rules in the local little league or the high school swim team or whatever else that is. So I think you can acknowledge people's legitimate concerns. You should not dismiss them as de facto bigotry. But what is the wrong approach, because it seems cynical and is morally wrong, is to decide that the way we're going to do this is by sister soldiering the trans community. Because it's not even what happened in the election. Like, we have seen Democrats seem culturally out of touch for some segment of voters. How Republicans have talked, like, certainly that particular ad, which was not about transports, it was about taxpayer funded gender assignment of surgery for undocumented immigrants in prison, which is, that would be an A+ answer to most unpopular position possible in American politics in a poli-sci 101 class. But if you just be authentic about it, acknowledge people's concerns, explain what, I guess this would be the form I give people, acknowledge that people have legitimate concerns, call out why Republicans are focusing on this particularly very small part of a larger issue, and express sympathy and compassion for the trans community, and that we should allow people to live their lives, to have in dignity and respect. And that's what we do as a country. And I think we are making it so much more complicated than it needs to be, because every Democrat looks like they just swallowed a bad oyster the second the question comes up. And so just talking about it, like, we need people in our coalition who disagree with us on a whole bunch of issues, and we can acknowledge their disagreements, treat them in good faith, but it doesn't mean we have to change our positions to align with the furthest right voter we need in our coalition.
Dan Pfeiffer, thank you so much for coming on and talking with me. Really
thank
appreciate
you.
It.
It was fun.
Thank you so much for listening to The Odd Years. If you liked what you heard or want to make a suggestion, leave us a review or recommend us to a friend. You're our best way to get the word out about what we do. And if you want more from the Cook Political Report, consider becoming a subscriber. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10. That's ODD, the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report and is produced by Becca Kaufman.